And for us, it's actually about breaking the silence and the courage that triggered a kind of Me Too movement back then, and the fact that we're still fighting for it today.
Yeah, and I love this phrase, if you cried only by yourself, it's kind of you never cried. You need some witnesses to really go through it.
You can't change the situation, but you can try to understand, and you can try to understand other people. And maybe you can be at peace with your story and everyone else and maybe do something good together.
Our producer is standing at the Statue of Peace on Birkenstrasse at the corner of Bremerstrasse and Berlin Moabit. A small bronze girl sits on a chair here. Next to her, there's an empty chair, and Natalie Han invites our producer to sit next to the girl. Natalie Jeonghwa Han is the chairwoman of the Korea Association. 15 years ago, she initiated the Trostfrauen, the Comfort Woman Working Group. She has been establishing the Trostfrauen Museum, the Comfort Woman Museum in Berlin. And in 2020, she and the Trostfrauen Working Group erected this peace statue.
That's why we said, sit next to me. When people sit in the chair, they start feeling empathy towards this figure.
Ari, as the girl is also called, sits here on behalf of all those girls and women who were forced into military prostitution during the Second World War. In Japan, these were mainly Korean girls, but there are also other women from the Asia-Pacific region who were abducted and forced into sexual slavery as so-called comfort women. And not only by the Japanese military. Within walking distance of the statue of Ari in Berlin, Moabit, is the Museum of Comfort Women. This is where we read about the German concentration camp and Wehrmacht brothels during the Second World War that we had never heard of before.
We have found that the statue serves as a symbol for everyone. Those directly affected by sexualized violence who come from all around the world, as well as individuals, both men and women, who may not have experienced it, but have a responsibility to address the issue. Because only by acknowledging this responsibility, we can hope to eradicate sexualized violence from our society. This is an incredibly challenging task. Sexualized violence occurs not only in times of war, but also on a daily basis. When we speak to young people, we emphasize that it happens in our everyday lives as well. Women and girls often feel fear when walking alone at night, because these incidents are a reality. In Germany, every 3 days, a woman is killed due to jealousy or domestic violence within relationships.
Our voices, our choices. Der geschlechterpolitische Podcast der Heinrich Böll Stiftung.
In the last three episodes of Our Voices, Our Choices, we explored how sexualized violence is systematically used as a weapon in war and violent conflicts, and how wars put feminist solidarities to the test. My colleagues Bettina Ritter, Vanessa Lovell, and Franziska Walzer examined the situations in Gaza, the Ukraine, and Sudan. In this fourth episode, I want to focus on activists who are working towards sustainable peace based on gender justice. Through their dedication, they help process both past and current armed conflicts, ultimately preventing new ones. Although they all live as migrants in Berlin, their work reaches as far as Colombia, Ukraine, Russia, and Japan. As individuals who have crossed borders, they effectively connect various international contexts with the German situation. However, not everyone agrees with this form of political intervention. In August 2024, the newspaper Taz published the headline, Kai Wegner's Long Arm, reporting that Kai Wegner, the governing mayor of Berlin, had halted funding for the Museum for Comfort Women's educational program, because that was what the Japanese embassy wanted. Their reasoning? According to them, the Statue of Peace fosters anti-Japanese sentiments, They claim that the representation is one-sided because the statue depicts Ari, a Korean girl, thus highlighting forced prostitution in Japan, while neglecting the fact that other countries have also coerced women into sex work. Natalie Han tells me that the Japanese government exerts pressure all over the world whenever it becomes aware of monuments like this one.
There is pressure everywhere. We can see that from our own experience with the museum, but we have also researched various statues worldwide. And there are quite a few. Many are withdrawn before they are even erected, because if the Japanese government finds out about them early on, they can't be put up at all.
In the educational program of the Museum for Comfort Women, young people and students are educated about the history of forced prostitution.
We've had students and schoolgirls from Mannheim, Heidelberg, Kassel, Bielefeld in Germany, and two groups from Japan in September. We achieved this with minimal advertising, as we lack the resources to promote extensively. Despite the pressure on the museum, a significant number of visitors have learned about us through word of mouth.
Until a few years ago, those affected were flown in from South Korea. But now, most of them are too old to travel this far.
The residents, too, with every signature they gave, they thanked us for our great work. I felt so grateful for that. Politicians, on the other hand, don't see it that way. They don't recognize the work we do. However, the residents were attentive to our actions and took the time to thank us.
In total, we gathered nearly 50,000 signatures, both online and offline, to save the statue. Despite this overwhelming support, the district mayor, Stephanie Remlinger, insists that the statue must be removed.
She had already made a speech at the district council meeting on the 9th of September where she firmly ruled out the possibility of keeping the statue, simply due to administrative practices. She said that they couldn't keep the statue because otherwise everyone who has set up a statue temporarily would end up wanting to keep it up permanently, and they can't allow that. She remained resolute in her position.
According to the city's proposal, the statue will be relocated to private property. Natalie Han doesn't believe this would be safer. Additionally, the location is crucial as a nearby museum provides essential context.
The bronze peace statue is an integral part of our museum concept. So maybe we would move somewhere else, especially since we may not want to stay in the central district of Berlin anymore because of how we are treated here. The decades of work and the fact that the first generation came to Germany as nurses, they were feminists and they fought for their rights and the rights of comfort women. It's a story that is well known internationally. It's one of the most successful feminist decolonial women's movements ever.
In Colombia, another successful international women's movement is still working for peace today. The struggle has been going on for decades. Claudia Tribin, who has been actively involved in the peace process in recent decades, traces the roots of this conflict deep into the past.
The conflict is a long conflict. If we only look at the last century, we've had more than 60 years of conflict. But actually, it's a conflict based on 500 years of inequality and exploitation, etc. But it has changed a lot since 1948. Since then, there have been so many people who have had to leave the country. So, of course, here in the diaspora, where we live in Berlin, many people come from Colombia.
Claudia Tribin lives in Berlin and is the coordinator of Xochiquicatl EFAO, an association for Latin American women that helps them to settle in a new city in a different country, far away from their home.
We offer social counseling, but also psychosocial counseling and legal advice, German language courses or, let's say, language support. but also literature circles and conversations about health, finances, sports, excursions, everything from A to Z. All topics are covered because in a new place and in a new situation where you don't know how anything works, it's important for people to share that they've had similar experiences.
When I arrive at her office in Berlin's Prenzlauer Berg, the connection between the association's work and the peace work is not immediately clear. But during our conversation, it becomes clear that the association's work also prevents violent conflicts, promotes peace, and deals with the war retrospectively, because many of the women had to go into exile. With over 450,000 people killed and many millions forced to flee, no one in Colombia has been left untouched by this conflict. For 52 years, the FARC guerrillas, the Colombian state, the paramilitaries, the ELN guerrillas, and other armed groups have fought each other. The conflict with the FARC guerrillas was the longest one. A significant milestone in Colombia's peace process happened on June 22, 2016, when the Colombian government agreed to a final ceasefire with the largest guerrilla group, the FARC-EPE. No peace agreement was reached with the other armed groups. However, work on the peace agreement had begun years earlier.
In 2014,
when it became clear that these talks about a peace agreement were going to take place, it was very important for many people to say, we want to participate in that process, and we want to make it clear that there are people who have to live in exile, because we want those people's interests, their issues, their reality to be taken into account. There was also the situation in Colombia where the women said that the agreement cannot only be negotiated by men in a patriarchal way. So the women joined forces and said women must sit at the table. And they managed to get women sitting on both sides, on the government side, but also on the side of the FARC guerrillas. And the issues that were important to women were addressed.
Women were involved, and for the first time in a peace process, a subcommission on gender issues was set up to integrate relevant issues into the peace agreement. In addition, 18 LGBTQI+ organizations participated in the peace process. 10 national experts working on the issue of sexualized violence took part in the negotiations. 60% of the victims heard were women. Several female FARC fighters were also sitting at the negotiating table. In this special feminist-influenced peace process, Claudia Tribin emphasizes three institutions.
They created three institutions, one for truth, one for reparations, and one for the search for missing persons.
Claudia Tribin herself worked as an interviewer for the Truth Commission. Historical and sociological research was conducted to explore the causes and dynamics of the conflict. Also, public hearings were held to give victims and witnesses a platform to tell their stories. Testimonies were collected from survivors, perpetrators, and others involved in the conflict.
I registered as an interviewer. Then I looked for people here in Germany, Colombians who wanted to give their testimonials about this conflict. In the beginning, there were only two women. Then four other women came to us, and we conducted 70 interviews here in Germany, all for this large report. In total, there were a little more than 2,000 interviews conducted with people from 24 countries, including Germany.
In the interviews, the participants were asked about their experiences in Colombia. What exactly had happened? Who was involved? What impact did this have on you? How has it shaped your situation here in exile? What happened after the war?
For many, the first important thing was being asked, what happened to you? That was the first time for many people that someone even cared. I think this was important for the whole nation. And then also to see that what happened was completely normalized. At first, no one is a victim. No one wants to be labeled, I am a victim. Yes, my mother disappeared, but I'm not a victim. People think these are just personal stories. It happened because my skirt was too short, or because I was in the wrong place, or because I had the wrong friends. And then suddenly, talking about it, realizing that this is not your destiny, people are interested, and there is a network that does everything and that's well organized. We have written some books with these women about exactly this question of what happened. And for many, that was the first time anyone had asked them that.
For many individuals, it became evident through the interviews how organized the murders and expulsions were. They began to perceive their fate not just as an individual experience, but as a collective one that also necessitates collective processing. The Truth Commission was not a judicial body. It could not impose legal penalties or convict offenders. Its purpose was to uncover the truth, clarify responsibilities, and lay the groundwork for future justice and reconciliation. The report provided specific recommendations on how the country could prevent future violence, achieve justice for the victims, and overcome social divisions.
We continue to believe in the idea of peace, because it's not that easy. A report alone doesn't make peace. It's a profound task, and its aim is to say, okay, we have to heal. And that was also very important in recent years that we tried to ask, okay, how do we achieve peace? Reconciliation and doing things differently might be the solution, but it's not easy.
In addition to seeking the truth and providing compensation to victims, a key component of the peace process was holding perpetrators accountable. To facilitate this, the Special Jurisdiction for Peace, Jurisdicción Especial para la Paz, or JEP, was established. These efforts are part of the broader concept of transitional justice, which consists of four main pillars: establishing the truth, prosecuting offenders, compensating victims, and ensuring non-repetition of violence. The goal of transitional justice is to uncover the truth, hold those responsible accountable, guarantee the rights of victims, and prevent future acts of violence.
In this transitional justice, the idea is that the person that in these facts involved.
In transitional justice, the idea is that the people involved can talk about it. The sentences can be reduced, and the aim is not to divide the punishment. For many people, peace means, I want to know where my family is, where the remains of my loved ones are. It doesn't help me to put that person in prison for 10 years. I want to find my family or my group. I want to know exactly what happened, because many people only ever heard, oh, we killed them because they were criminals. So the dignity of these people was destroyed. They want to hear, it wasn't because they were criminals. It was a strategy to drive people out of the village. That's important to many people.
For many people, knowing what happened to their relatives is more important than seeing severe punishments for the perpetrators. Some lower-ranking offenders have even named those who gave the orders. To ensure that international human rights standards are upheld, the international community, the Inter-American System, and the International Criminal Court have monitored the peace process.
A judge in Bogota might say, that was nothing. They say it was nothing. But when those families and groups went to these international bodies and the cases were analyzed, in the end they said, yes, the Colombian state is guilty of this and that. That has happened in some cases, and it's very important for the people and the individuals.
As in all wars, women and individuals perceived as women have been disproportionately targeted in the conflict in Colombia. This highlights the importance of giving special attention to their role in the process of dealing with the past.
Women were the ones who supported the social networks in these communities. So they were also targeted in that sense. When these armed men threatened or eliminated these women, they destroyed the social context. So they were often the targets of these armed men, because when a village or a community is without structure, it's easier to get in and say, okay, everyone's gone. This land belongs to us now. So in that sense, it was a tool for establishing and consolidating this power.
Controlling land was essential for acquiring political power, economic benefits, and strategic advantages in the drug trade. As a result, various armed groups occupied and fought over territories belonging to their opponents and civilians. Claudia Tribin and her colleagues aim to share the insights they have gained from the peace process to help others in similar conflicts and wars.
Und mit diese ganze Ergebnis, ne, von diese Bericht von
the work of the Truth Commission, the transitional justice process, and everything that is going on now has also been very important. And it's important that we share this experience. Here we work in an association, but in our lives we also work with people from Syria, from Afghanistan, or people from Ukraine. And that's to say, okay, peace isn't just about one country. It has to do with a global situation. And we have done all of this. Every Truth Commission or conflict that has been resolved or partially resolved has discovered new strategies, new pedagogies, and new resources. And we would like to share this with other communities. In these wars in Ukraine and Russia, it seems impossible to just sit with the enemy. How could I sit with the enemy? But we have to create space somewhere to make that possible. And that's what we're trying to do in Colombia.
Next, our producer travels from Berlin Prenzlauer Berg to Werder, where she watches a performance of the Playback Theater in the East German countryside. Olga was born in Ukraine, but due to Russia's war against the Ukraine, she now lives in Berlin with her partner Victoria, who is from Russia. For privacy reasons, we have changed both of their names. Together, they are the conductors of Playback Theater Berlin. Playback Theater performs publicly, as it did here in Werder, specifically for an East German audience. But it is also booked by organizations that want to support migrants from Ukraine or Russia, for example. Here they play themselves on the Playback Theater stage, a form of theater in which the actors perform stories based on input from the audience. At the start of the performance, each actor shares a personal story related to a general theme, such as German reunification, love and partnerships, or childhood dreams. Then, members of the audience can come on stage and tell their story in a conversation with the so-called conductor of the evening. The ensemble then interprets these stories by creating short improvised scenes based on what has been shared.
I think for people, playback, it's like a mural, but not the same mural when you need to brush your teeth or do something with your face. It's like an interesting true mural, but with some deepening, with more interesting ways to see your story, your life, and this mirror accept you because we really train to be neutral and acceptable for any stories. And when somebody see their story on the stage in interesting way, it's kind of I see myself in different interesting way, but it's myself, it's me. It's not somebody else. Yeah, it's for a teller, I think. And for audience, it's kind of, okay, but I have similar stories, so I'm not the only one with this problem or these feelings. I feel connection with other people.
In the Colombian peace process, the testimonies of contemporary witnesses were gathered and documented in books and online for everyone to access. In Playback Theater, people's stories are brought to life through performances, but here too. It is the individual experiences that lay the foundation for peaceful coexistence, or as Victoria from Russia puts it.
Playback Theater is more not about opinions, but about stories, which invites us as a transition from logical level to empathy level. And we cannot say this man, no, you're wrong. You know, I mean, it's a story. You need to listen to a story. And story also can bring some change.
Yeah, because when you hear opinion, you already are ready to be with your opinion, with the same or with opposite. But when you hear story, you are interesting. It's like a hearing fairy tales in childhood when you are totally deep in this process, in this picture, and you can be there and you can feel these feelings of other person, and doing this, you understand more how to be in their shoes. And it's not a fight of opinions, it's just stories.
Although playback theater is about narratives, and narratives is very strong thing. So narratives, what building our opinion and construct the society. So in the way, for me, playback theater, if it used not in a proper way, could be really a dangerous weapon. In a way, like, government would come and wanted to cooperate with playback groups here and said, okay, we have a contract for 2 years. Would you perform for the soldiers who would be back? But it wouldn't be even their narratives. They call it under the copywriting, which is like so much not in values of playback theater. So, of course, they said no. Well, maybe I would make example on Cuba. It's the same happened with playback groups. So mm-hmm. on Cuba, they started to do playback many years ago. And then the government came to them and said, we're very interested in your work, but we're interested for you to play certain stories. And this playback group also said, no, thanks. So now they, you know, still poor artists. They do actually performances on the streets as a social activism, but they keep their values. So because playback theater is also standing firmly for human rights, that's why the values is also about raising the voices, always pay attention on the voices which are unheard in the society most of the time and support it.
This powerful, unifying, and almost therapeutic method of playback theater is even used by the two of them against the background of Russia's ongoing war of aggression against Ukraine.
It's a very tricky moment to try build this nice dialogue and a nice space to talk to each other like a humans. It's a very triggering situation. And I think we need to be very careful about what we are doing now, especially in this ongoing trauma situation, and to find another ways to do it. Because, for example, even Russian language for Ukrainians, it's triggering situation, really, really physical triggering. So when we do performance in English, it's easy.
Make people feel safe. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense for them. Now it's a hard phase, and in a conflict transformation, even topic, you cannot really do the dialogue between sides during the hard phase. Yes, when it's finishing, then yes. But what we can do, so for me, I call it not dialogue, because I think in this work, it's becoming so heavy with expectations. You know, like, we need to finish the dialogue with some conclusions and decisions. So for me, we call it more connection. So if we do performances on a topic of war, it will be terrible for Russians and Ukrainians in the audience. We do it separately. Yulia do lots of work for Ukrainian community and I do for Russian. But when we come together, we need to find the third topic. You know, if we, for example, do the performance about life in Berlin after relocation, how our lives changed, what is the struggle, here we can connect.
German bureaucracy. German,
yeah, for example.
Yeah, everybody has a lot of stories of this.
Yes, or something more about life. I mean, stories from the past. And then we can connect. And then it's more easily to build the trust between us. So for the future, we can start these conversations more easily. And I think now many, you know, of us trying to push this big stone, like, we need to create this space for dialogue. But then it's like we fail. And then I think we're losing trust more and more between the communities, which I feel very sad. So I feel like what now we can do is do this as a starting point, and then it will be more easy to, you know, go into dialogues about what's going on now.
where a joint reappraisal of the Russian war of aggression against Ukraine is not possible. The two work separately with the Russian and Ukrainian migrant communities in Germany.
Well, it's very useful now to apply it for, you know, communities separately, you know, like you work with Ukrainian community for healing, for, you know, for basic support of basic needs, like to reunite it through the stories, you know, is already a big support. Or, you know, when it's finished, because war has so many different stages, unfortunately, for decades and decades afterwards, till the reconciliation moment. So, and then right after the hard phase is finished, then we can start applying playback more for dialogue. Now playback works for different purposes, you know, for, you know, support and work with trauma and healing.
I think one of the good example was this year, 2 days before 24th of February, which is a huge date. And we did a performance which called The Day Before. So we asked about stories, how you remember you felt the day before, because it was many different news or some information, and did you believe in this or did you not? And what you did day before? And of course, people started from this, split it into groups. I believed, I don't believed, or I wanted not believe. And then they continue with more harder stories when it's started, because it's logic. And then we together explored these stories and heard these stories. And then in third part, it came naturally. They started to talk how it's now, how they started to build new life here, and what they explored in their inside of themselves, and how now they found some strengths. And, I don't know, new friends here and new possibilities, maybe.
Victoria says the method has also had an effect on their personal lives. With her mother in Russia, she did not practice playback theater, but she was able to use its basic idea, listening to the story of the other person and finding a connection through it.
So my mom is from Russia, and she's like very much under propaganda. She's watching TV. And, you know, she's like using the phrases from the TV. And sometimes for me, it's so hard to speak with her if we're touching any topic of social dimension. I'm like becoming, no, okay, let's not talk about it because, you know, it's escalating. So after this story, I came to visit my mom and I realized, okay, instead of saying, no, mom, you're talking bullshit, you know, how you can justify, like, what actions of Stalin? So instead of this, I start asking my mom, tell me stories. Tell me more stories about your childhood, about school you went to, some difficulties. So I listened and I was very curious to listen to stories. And then together with my mom, we came to the conclusion that, yeah, actually, Stalin was an asshole. And all the repressions and all the things Soviet Union was doing inside and outside of the world was also shit. But together we came to this because my mom felt like her stories is valued. I'm not attacking her life. I also say, of course, you know, every life period, whenever you are, of course, it's valued. There is many, you know, colors. It's not black and white. So this is also provoke change, you know, when we really listen a story behind the opinion of the person. Like I did with my mom, then we can change our patterns. I can change my pattern, also being an activist, and try to listen first rather to share my opinion.
The activists I spoke to focus on the perspectives of marginalized groups, such as women, queers, and migrants, at every stage of armed conflict. Their work can help to achieve sustainable and gender-just peace. You can listen to and subscribe to all episodes of Our Voices, Our Choices, and all other podcasts from the Heinrich Böll Foundation on the podcast app of your choice. For feedback and suggestions, please email us at podcast@böll.de. and feel free to recommend us. This podcast is a production of the Audio Collective. This episode was produced by Emily Toomey. Thanks for listening and see you next time.